Hello and welcome to the 21cc podcast brought to you by the Chartered Institute of Building. I'm Rod Sweet, editor of Global Construction Review. I'm going for the understatement of the year when I say, it's been a bit hot lately, hasn't it? I'm sure you've noticed. And for this episode, we assembled a panel of leading experts on climate and the built environment to ask what can we do, starting now, to make towns and cities, schools, care homes and streetscapes safe and livable, even as the long-predicted warming intensifies. I'll take you now to that panel discussion held last week to meet the experts. Hello, everyone. Thank you all very much for giving us your time today. We're now breaking heat records as a matter of course. And as we continue to spew CO2 into the atmosphere, it's only going to get hotter. What practical things can we do to our built environment now and in the medium to long term to give ourselves a chance to survive in this heat? Joining us today in alphabetical order are Dr. Arash Beyzai, Senior Lecturer in Building Energy at Loughborough University, an expert on thermal comfort, overheating, and health in buildings. How have you managed in the heat, Arash?
Oh, hi, Rod. I think my top priority has been to keep the heat out during the day. So I've been drawing all the curtains, making sure that get as minimum possible heat inside during the day. And then I think at night, especially when the temperatures drop at night, because we had some nights which were quite hot, but on those nights where it was cooler, obviously opening the windows, I'm lucky because I can get some sort of cross ventilation in the bedroom that I sleep, so that's quite effective. But also I've used fans in the recent heat wave because no matter what I did, it was still too hot to sleep, especially for my kids at night. So I've been using fans and cold showers. I think that's what I did.
Okay, good. Thanks for that. Dr. Macarena Cardenas is Senior Advisor on Resilience and Nature at the UK Green Building Council. Macarena, are we going to get through this?
Hi, thank you for inviting me. I'm pleased to be here. We are going to get through this for sure. I think inherently we are resilient. We just need to find our best ways to adapt and cope with it. And ultimately, at least in the UK, the heat is not going to last forever. So we're going to find our way.
That's nice to hear. Hayley Fowler is Professor of Climate Change Impacts and Head of the Water Engineering Group at Newcastle University. Last year, she was awarded a Royal Society Faraday Discovery Fellowship for her Extreme Futures project, improving how we forecast flash floods and prolonged storms. I have to say, Hayley, that doesn't sound very reassuring.
No, I mean, I don't think it is. Unfortunately, this is the least extreme climate we're going to live in our lifetimes. The good thing about the project is we will understand a lot more about the types of extremes we'll experience in the future, and we'll be able to forecast those extremes much better, which will be good for early warnings and for climate adaptation as well.
And Jordan Turner is Senior Lecturer at the University of the Built Environment. Welcome to the show, Jordan. What's your top tip for keeping cool?
Thanks for having me, Rod. And yeah, a lot of very, very similar things of trying to minimize that solar gain, blacking everything out as much as possible. When it's cooler in the morning and nighttime, opening the windows, letting that cooler air through, and then trying to essentially black everything out and stop the sunlight getting through all the many windows that we have throughout the day.
Okay, good. And to chair this discussion, we are honoured to have Saul Humphrey, FCIOB, this year's CIOB president, an industry veteran and professor of sustainable construction management at Anglia Ruskin University. Saul, you've been watching this space for many years. Is there any satisfaction at all in being able now to say, I told you so?
No, Rod, no whatsoever. But thank you for the question. Now, you can't take any joy from that, can you? It's an appalling situation we're in. And I'm really concerned that we now will share the harm that's been caused by our failure to act sooner. It's going to be much harder to fix it now. The best time to have started would have been 30, 40 years ago. It would have been much simpler, but the next best time is now. So let's not give up hope. We can still make this survivable. but it's going to need urgent mitigation of emissions and urgent adaptation to increase our resilience. This Haley's comment about this is the least extreme climate you'll experience in your lifetime resonates. It's true. This is now going to get worse and worse and worse unless we act immediately.
Okay, thanks, Saul. Now, before I hand the reins over to you, Saul, Dr. Susan Rofe, Emeritus Professor of Architectural Engineering at Heriot Watt University, couldn't join us today as planned, but I'll be speaking with her later, and thanks to the magic of radio, listeners, you can hear her startling insights after the panel discussion. And now, Saul, over to you.
Thanks, Rod. I think the idea of this was to focus on what we can do. No point looking back and reminding ourselves what we should have done, or wouldn't it have been better if we'd have only had done that? There are still things we can do, and there's a timescale for doing them. So I wonder if we could just humour me and work through that. What could we do immediately, say by next summer? Arash, you talked about being able to sleep at night. I think you also did a bit of research on having a cooling mattress. Did I read that?
Yeah.
So forgive me for pushing you towards a certain answer, and that might sound a little bit light-hearted, but more seriously, perhaps, what would you do immediately?
Yeah, I think my proposed intervention for next summer is straightforward. I think we should begin a rapid program of installing external shading on our buildings that are most vulnerable to overheating. When we think about keeping buildings cool, people often jump immediately to air conditioning. But before we use energy to remove heat from a building, I think the first priority should be to stop that heat entering in the first place. So during hot weather, a large proportion of unwanted heat enters through windows, particularly those facing south and west. And sunlight passes through the glass and it's absorbed by the floors, walls, and furniture. And this energy is then released as heat inside the room. Once the heat is inside, it becomes much more difficult and obviously much more expensive to remove. In many homes, we have internal curtains and blinds, and they can help with things like glare and provide some protection. But by the time the sunlight reaches an internal blind, much of its energy has already passed through the window. And I think external shading is more effective because it sort of intercepts solar radiation before it reaches the glass. And this doesn't necessarily require complicated architecture. We have external shutters, awnings, blinds, canopies, and also properly positioned shading panels can all make a significant difference. We also have trees and vegetation that can also provide valuable shading, although they take longer to establish. Our own research using two closely matched houses has shown that external shading can reduce peak indoor temperatures by as much as 6 degrees Celsius. And that's not a marginal improvement. During heat wave, a reduction of several degrees can be the difference between an uncomfortable room and potentially a dangerous one.
Macarena, can I ask what you would do?
Before I answer, if you don't mind, I think something that it is very important for me is to bring what the definition of really what resilience means. And what we've been looking at is that we are responding when the emergency has already happened. And that actually is not resilience. So resilience really is about that preparation. And what Arash largely said is actually before the heat comes and preventing it for happening. And let me give you an example because I think this is really typical. So I'm a mother of a 7-year-old daughter. And when we were just in the middle of the first heat wave, the school was really struggling to keep the children safe in their school. It's an old building, it's a 1800 building, beautiful one. And I was genuinely concerned, as many of the other parents. So they parents really got the idea of doing a fundraising for getting portable air conditioning units. As a mother, as a parent, of course, I was sort of relieved my daughter was going to be able not just to be safe, but actually to learn and to carry on with their education without disruption. But obviously, as a professional, my first thought was, well, here is when we are reacting. This is the short-term perspective that which means that we are undermining the rest of
the consequences that this has for sustainability and many other things. So maladaptation in some cases. What about if we actually provide recommendations that consider the passive cooling as a key measure for populations with high vulnerabilities, such as schools, hospitals, and other healthcare systems? And the core practice here would be to do night cooling, night heat purging by actually widening, just simply by widening the opening of the windows and having a protocol for doing so in these settings. And we saw the effects of this through the research that Hora Lee did with us for the climate resilience roadmap, which made a significant difference. Same as what Arash said, several degrees have been decreased, and therefore these buildings can be used later on. So here the point is, we don't necessarily need much more innovation for these immediate emergencies that we are likely to have next year, but actually how we implement it and how we enable them to be implemented before they come an emergency.
Thank you. And with a super El Nino now upon us or emerging, that action in hospitals, schools, care homes does seem very, very appropriate right now, or certainly before the next summer. I mean, if sooner we get through this one. Jordan, what would you do?
I think that, there is an element of the education side of it. I'll look out of my own window during the heat waves, and the amount of neighbours that I've can see with windows and the back doors wide open. I feel like going around and say, "No, close them." You're letting all the heat in, and just simple things like that, where that there are still many, many people just unaware of some of the things they can do. But I think the second thing outside of perhaps things that we can directly do is something I would touch on is around green spaces. And there's a lot of research and evidence into that now, around the cooling effects that that can have, particularly around buildings and more so in our cities and town centres, for trying to cool buildings down, where we have got more trees, more plants, and that cooling effect by sometimes as much as 5 degrees. Because we know the benefits of plants and green spaces for reflecting sunlight much, much better, of course, than what concrete does. And in itself, that will cool, the atmosphere down in surrounding buildings, so that we're not just, of course, focusing on our own houses, but when we're out and about, going into high streets, shopping, whatever it may be, that we can also stay comfortable there as well.
Jordan, thank you. I know from my own experience, rushing across London this summer, it's only been the Elizabeth line that's kept me cool. Some of the other underground platform stations, trains have been unbearable. It's been too much. If I just take a pause there for a second, because that was the immediate tactical response to today's situation. If I could turn to Hayley now and wind forward 5 years and ask perhaps more strategically, what should we be doing to adapt for a 2030 reality?
I think, I mean, there's lots of things that we need to do, but I think one thing that would be nice if we could actually realistically achieve something by 2030 would be to actually create a network of climate resilient cooling refuges in every community. Now, this is something that already exists in other countries, and I think the good thing is we could potentially do this with existing buildings. We wouldn't need to build lots of new facilities. We can adapt buildings we already have, libraries, schools, community centres, GP surgeries, certainly care homes obviously need this. All of these places already really need to stay safe and comfortable during periods of extreme heat. I think, in the US, a lot of people go to shopping centres because they're air conditioned. What I would suggest, though, is we need to use some of the measures that have already been talked about today to basically provide passive cooling measures first before we think about air conditioning. So we might want to use external shading. We might want to paint our roofs white, for example, to provide reflective roofs and get some of that heat away. More trees and planting around buildings as well. We might have to put air conditioning in as well in some places. And I think this coupled potentially with some maximum temperature, working temperatures, maximum workplace temperatures. This is something that's just been recommended in the Well Adapted UK report by the Climate Change Committee as well, would actually be an immediate response to the heat we've already seen. It really matters because actually we've seen lots of deaths recently. We see excess deaths every time we have heat waves in the UK and other countries. The recent June heat wave caused as many excess deaths in the UK as we saw from the 9/11 attacks in New York. And I think that's quite sobering, actually. We don't think of these things because they're silent deaths, but actually they still matter. And our infrastructure is built for a climate that no longer exists. And that's a direct quote from the Well Adapted UK report. So these cooling refuges would actually give people somewhere to go during a heat wave. And they could also provide support. They could have emergency generators and things like that. So you could actually provide support if there were power outages and things, which is going to be potentially an issue as well with heat. Paris has already got a network of these cool islands that people can access during heat waves. And Phoenix, Arizona has also got cooling centers as well. And I know that Madrid as well, lots of cities in Spain have these. So we don't need to completely redesign our cities. I think this is the key message. We can do a lot with what we have already with simple measures by adapting the buildings we already have.
Thank you, Hayley. That's insightful. I was wondering if you think we'll be at 2 degrees centigrade above the benchmark by 2030 or not.
In the UK, we're planning for 2 degrees by 2050, potentially 2.5 degrees by 2050. I certainly hope we're not at 2 degrees by 2030. I mean, none of the, climate models suggest that we'll be at 2 degrees by 2030. What we'll probably see is a temporary overshoot of 1.5 next year. With the super El Nino, we might see 1.7, it might even be 1.8 degrees next year, horrifyingly. But then hopefully it'll go down a little bit again before we get the next big El Nino. We won't be at 2 degrees by 2030.
Okay, Hayley, thank you. As long as you promise. Jordan, can you bail me out? We're still in 2030. Hayley's given some great tips. What would anything you can add for that time scale, 5 years' time?
I mean, I start to bring in a little bit around the policy focus here, in which as the attention perhaps so long not being on the wrong thing, I don't think it is a bad thing, but perhaps being so focused on trying to keep warm, warm home plans and keeping things warm, that an unintended consequence, which ever since MEES or minimum energy efficiency standards has come in, is that we've not focused on energy efficiency from the opposite end of the scale, where we've got this real danger now that by creating such warm, energy efficient homes, that we do end up in this scenario where we're essentially, to put it in simple terms, cooking everybody in summertime. And I think where this becomes an even bigger problem is if these minimum energy efficiency standards are going to come into effect, which we know are now certainly going to happen, increasing a home from an EPC rating of an E to a B by packing it with insulation, trying to make it warm, keep it warm, put in extra layers of glass, single glazing to double glazing, whatever it may be, cavity wall insulation, that's great. In wintertime, we're going to create a much, much warmer home. It's going to be more comfortable. And we need that. Of course we do. It's not me saying scrap the idea, forget it. We need that to happen. But the consequence of that is in summertime, as we've seen with some of the new builds, I'm just reported actually on a house which is not too far from myself, coincidentally. They measured the internal heat during the last heat wave that we've just had, and it was 33 degrees. So you've got an EPC A rating house and it's 33 degrees inside the house. That's not good. The point that I'm trying to make with the issue around MEES and insulation is that, of course, if we go just purely insulating buildings as a way to try and increase energy efficiency, then yes, of course, it can keep buildings cooler, it can keep them warmer through the colder months. But one of the problems we have is that, well, if we're getting lots of solar gain and we're trapping that heat in the building, it's got nowhere to escape.
Jordan, thank you. That's really insightful. Arash, if I wind forward another 5 years and give us a 10-year lead-in, what would you recommend we do by 2035?
Yeah, I think by 2035, we must have made low energy cooling a normal part of our homes, hospital, and care environments. As summers become hotter, we have still passive measures such as external shading and ventilation. They still remain as our first line of defense, but I think passive measures will not always be enough, particularly during prolonged heat waves when the daytime and nighttime temperatures remain high for several consecutive days. I think the challenge is that we cannot simply respond by installing conventional air conditioning everywhere. I think what we need is a middle layer between passive design and conventional air conditioning, which is highly efficient, low energy cooling that cools people rather than trying to refrigerate the entire building. And I think I'm going to talk about two technologies. The first one is basically the simple electric fans, particularly the ceiling fans. Fans do not significantly reduce the air temperature, but instead they increase air movement around our bodies, helping sweat evaporate and increasing heat loss from the skin. This can make a room feel several degrees cooler without the energy that's required to mechanically cool all the air in that room. But I think by 2035, ceiling fans should be routinely considered in new homes and during the refurbishment of existing buildings. This should be particularly common in bedrooms, classrooms, hospital wards, and care homes. Ceiling fans are already recognized within the newly released TM59 methodology that's used to assess overheating risk in new homes, but installation remains far from standard practice. And the second technology is a technology that we've been researching over the past few years. It's the targeted bed cooling. We all know sleep is one of the first things that's affected by overheating. A hot bedroom can increase the time that it takes to fall asleep. It causes repeated waking. It reduces our overall sleep quality. And then poor sleep affects our health, our concentration, our productivity, and our ability to cope with the heat the following day. So our research has shown that actively cooled beds can maintain thermal comfort, and it can also improve sleep quality, even in bedrooms with air temperatures of around 30 degrees Celsius. The system we studied used around only 60 watts for less energy than would generally be required by an air condition to cool the entire bedroom. So I think my vision for 2035 is not a country covered in energy intensive air conditioning units. It's a country in which buildings first keep the heat out and then use quiet, affordable, and highly efficient technologies to cool people where and when cooling is needed. I think the central principle is do not cool the entire building when you can safely and effectively cool the person.
Arash, thank you. That's really insightful. I'm conscious also that this rush to install air conditioning would create a sudden impact of embodied energy, the carbon intensity of the components that are used to make the product, and then the extra heat load in the particularly in urban centres where these air conditioning units are being installed. So our cities could be getting hotter as a consequence of trying to cool the rooms. I was going to pause at 2040 and ask for a sort of benchmark proposition there, but I'm going to skip that and go straight to 2050, if I may, because by then, Hayley's told me I can talk about 2.5 degrees above the benchmark by 2050 as being a realistic proposition, not the one that we cherish or welcome, but a realistic, possibly likely scenario. But I'm conscious about putting that in the framework that we've already exceeded 7 of the 9 planetary boundaries. There's a real risk that we may have already initiated certain tipping points. I think at 2.5 degrees, we'll initiate a whole lot more. Hayley, help me out here. What do we have to do to survive and prosper in a 2050 world?
Well, before I do, actually, I'd like to add something to the previous discussion. I think one of the things we've kind of missed in our discussion so far is buildings that aren't owned by the people who live in them, right? So rented buildings or rented premises for businesses are something that we've kind of missed in our discussion so far. And I think that one of the really important things that we need to bring in sooner than 2050, and probably within the next decade or so, is mandatory overheating regulations, actually. Because I'll give you an example. My mum goes to a dementia program every day. Their office got to 43 degrees in Newcastle in the June heat wave. Now it's a really poorly built building, and it's got glass windows on one side, and it was closed overnight. But to be that temperature in the morning when they opened up the building is quite horrific. And they couldn't get the building below 30 degrees inside. And so they had to close for a whole week. And we're talking about people here who have really poor, that they rent that building, so they have no control over the heating and cooling of that building. So there needs to be regulation in place well before for people in rented properties and rented premises as well. But if we look ahead to 2050, I think, one of the things we need to start thinking about in cities is really a much more joined up approach. Not just to heat, actually, but to thinking about all sorts of other issues with extreme weather as well. So potentially heat, flooding, biodiversity, right? Improving the way we live in our cities. And I think that we can do that by really creating blue green corridors and features across towns and cities. And we're going to need a long time to do this because it takes a long time for trees to grow, right? But we need to start this today, and we need to link up these green areas so that people can use them and enjoy them. And by that I mean parks, waterways, neighborhoods with trees, wetlands, rain gardens, other nature-based features. We're already starting to do this a little bit in Newcastle. They're transforming the main shopping street in Newcastle, putting trees in the middle of it. We've recently worked with the city council to at the university to actually develop a solution to flooding in part of the city by building a big new piece of green blue green infrastructure on the town wall. It would have been nice to also build trees around that as well. We weren't allowed, but these are the types of things that need to be thought about in terms of systems thinking, tackling lots of problems at once. Green spaces help cities keep cooler during heat waves. They reduce flood risk, they improve air quality, and they support biodiversity. And obviously, they make places much happier, people are happier and healthier, and more, it's a more enjoyable space to live in. There's already been quite a lot of examples of this type of approach being taken elsewhere. So there's a particular example of a big roundabout in Copenhagen, and they've basically greened that roundabout. They've put trees in, they've put benches in, they've put areas to eat food in. That the maximum temperatures in that location have reduced by 8 degrees since they put that green space in. Cafes have grown up around the area. House prices or the prices of apartments around the area have gone up substantially because it's a more attractive place to live. And so I think the idea is to have a network basically of these new green spaces that can actually help to cool down cities. They can also provide multiple benefits. People can then still enjoy, hopefully, being outdoors during hot weather. They won't have to go to these cooling centres. And nature can be woven into everyday life. So we can basically all have happier, healthier lives.
Who wouldn't welcome that? Hayley, thank you. That's a really reassuring note to pause on. But before I let you off quite so easily, can I just ask if you can help me to help explain to us the kind of, we're talking about a plus two or 2.5 degree temperature here as an average. This mean sounds like quite a manageable, tolerable extreme. But should we be looking at the tail risks? Should we be looking at the extreme events that occur as a consequence of that warming atmosphere, warmer ocean? What does that look like?
By 2050, we did some work with the Met Office. By 2050, we can expect to see 45 degrees in the UK. We found a heat wave of 9 days in a row that were over 40 degrees somewhere in the UK. It's quite shocking, actually. And the temperatures that we're already seeing in places in Europe are very shocking this year to me. And what I will say is that climate models, climate model projections are I suppose the real world is changing faster than we predict with climate models as well. So, you know, these estimates of heat waves for the 2050s might actually be underestimates, if anything. We've been talking about resilience today, and that's we need to do much more in terms of actually adapting to the extreme weather that we're already experiencing, and that is going to get worse. But we cannot forget that we need to reduce our emissions of fossil fuels as fast as we can. And that's the elephant in the room because we haven't addressed that today. We can't afford to do one without the other. We've got to do both. And both as fast as we can, honestly, because climate is changing very fast.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I don't think we can adapt to a plus 3 degree world. I really think that's impossible. So we have to avoid that happening. 2 degrees is scary enough. Three is unthinkable because by then it's gone too far. It's too late. We're getting into those feedback loops, those cascade effects. It's horrific to even contemplate. Haley, thank you. Jordan, Macarena, Arash, thank you all ever so much. Rob, thank you for facilitating the conversation. I've learned a lot today, and I hope our listeners do too.
We're not done yet. After the panel discussion, I spoke to Dr. Susan Rofe, Emeritus Professor of Architectural Engineering at Heriot Watt University. She has written 24 books on building for climate change. The latest, Adaptive Thermal Comfort at the Extremes, came out in March. She also built Britain's first integrated photovoltaic roof, which she installed on her house in 1995. Sue has spoken out strongly against glass office towers, and I was keen to ask her about that.
What about towers, office towers?
Hello. They're madness. You see, Jamie Dimon, again, he's threatening to build in Canary Wharf a new glass tower designed by Foster's, which will use more electricity than 175,000 homes. So nobody's flagging that. These are super polluting. And I'm worried about Andy Burnham too, because he put in something like 18 glass towers over 100 meters high in Manchester, which is basically it's foreign investments, you know. So it's a glass wall with no opening windows. So these people are stuck in there over, I mean, if you face west, they're just like overheating terribly. And the only thing you can do is use more energy for air conditioning. I mean, it's these buildings will be abandoned eventually, because they're so mad. Why would you build a greenhouse? And I think London's got 11 new glass towers planned, you know, super talls. And so why doesn't anybody mention that that much new air conditioning load in a heating climate during extreme heat waves will, I mean, it has the capacity to put the grid down in the whole of London. We live in a wild west where the rich can get away with anything.
Sue is also wary of whizzy new technological fixes and advocates a return to time-tested methods of building.
I think probably that we have gone down two or three dead ends in a way. I think there are, and people will disagree with me on this, but there's a lot to be said for the traditional English or British house type, with all its faults. I mean, they could be corrected. The traditional cavity wall construction, which is such a sensible construction. Now, developers don't like it because it takes longer to build and it may cost a little more. It's a building system that suited us very well because we're rainy. You know, people always say Britain's rainy. It doesn't feel like it now, but it's a system that is useful in the wet climates, the driving rain, and it's also useful for isolating indoor climates from the outdoor climates. So in the extreme heat, buildings that do really well are cavity wall buildings because the outside is a heavyweight, say a brick skin, which is a capacitive insulation that slows down temperature movement through it. Then you've got your air gap, which again, or insulated air gap, which is another form of insulation. And then you have the isolated internal leaf, which can store the cool in hot weather or the warmth in cold weather. And it's a really sensible, robust construction, but we seem to have abandoned it now for lightweight systems. So I would go back to a cavity wall construction for housing, for instance. Number two, architects have been very seduced by glass and glazing. So a lot of modern buildings, let's not forget that a lot of modern housing and particularly flats are overheating extremely badly now, largely because they have very few opening windows to get rid of the heat, but also many of them are overglazed. So you have, in the old days, you had a door and you had windows and you could open the windows and ventilate. Whereas now you have like a large patio door, for instance, even if it's onto a balcony. So you have no way of, during the day, letting the heat out. So you get back from work and you've got really a hot box, a highly insulated sort of oven, really. I mean, I think that a lot of the birds are coming home to roost on that one. And so we've got get back to sensible, robust construction with thermal mass, get rid of the overglazing of buildings, and then relearn how to naturally ventilate buildings. You know, sensible cross ventilation, even in flats, or the use of windows where you can use the stack effect, like the old sash windows. Basically, wake up and smell the problem. We could go towards the virtuous circles, but we're still peddling the old vicious circles, unfortunately, because, of course, the more air conditioning you have, the more emissions you have, the more heat you're putting back out into the city. There's no way. Well, there are ways off that treadmill, but we have to be farsighted. Nobody's really taken the challenge of designing for a heating world seriously.
I hope this podcast hasn't been too unsettling. The goal was to try and give us a new sense of agency. I found the heat waves this year scary, the feeling of, this is just the start of how it's going to be. But as we've heard, there are things we can do. A big thanks to Sue, Saul, Jordan, Macarena, Arash, and Haley, and CIOB's Amanda Williams for helping to pull it all together. Stay cool, and see you next time.